Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode here at the Damage Report. I'm John Arola. It's a Tuesday, and so we're very lucky to be joined once again by Nina Turner. Nina, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. Happy New Year to you and the squad.
Happy New Year. Yes, Happy New Year to you. People like to say New Year, New You. I'm hoping New Year, just anything different. Anything new at all. Do you have any big resolutions you're jumping into the new year with?
The same ones, you know, carrying over from the years past. Read more, exercise more, walk more, you know the usual.
Yes, I think all of those are good. Yes. Okay. Well, if you're out there watching and you have a resolution you think could be inspiring to others, feel free to send comments. We'll read them during our breaks. And over the next 90 minutes, we've got a lot that we're going to be talking about. A couple different updates on the investigation into last January 6th. A little bit of a preview of what might be coming in 2 days on this January 6th. We've got horrific snowstorms. We've got Airbnb dealing with racism. Dan Crenshaw and Marjorie Greene feuding. And let's see. I'm going to sort of preview a board game. And you might be asking yourself, how could that possibly be justified on a political news show? Well, stay tuned to the end of the show to find out why. Anyway, with all that said, if you wouldn't mind hitting the like button and sharing the stream, that'd be great. Nina, you ready to jump into this?
Let's go.
Okay, let's do it. You know, this is sort of behind the scenes information, so I'm still in my shed, hopefully resuming soon. I'm going to go get COVID tested today. I hate Skype. So we have Skype. That's how we're communicating. And like, you can't reorient your windows. It's so annoying. I can barely see the little preview. What is wrong with Yes. Skype? It's been around for 40 years. Basic stuff.
I thought
stuff
it was just
do.
Me. John, thank you for saying those words out loud. I thought it was just me.
It's like there's like two boxes. I can't drag one to make it bigger. One of the biggest corporations in the history of the earth. Anyway, that's my issue. My resolution is to make Skype better. Anyway, okay, let's talk about this now. On New Year's Eve, Bernie Kerik, who's a former advisor to former President Donald Trump, delivered a cache of documents to the January 6th committee. And one bit of those documents is raising a few eyebrows, and I think justifiably so. This is their what they're calling a strategic communications plan. So understand, this was a plan that was put together and circulated in Trump circles in advance of last January 6th. So in the time between the last election and the inauguration. And this plan includes a list of conservative social media influencers to tap to push Trump's false claims of widespread election fraud and ultimately overturn the results. It listed different categories of influencers. So what they're calling big names like Ben Shapiro, Candace Owens, and the Daily Wire. And that is a massive indictment of America that those people and organizations are allowed to be big names. But anyway, medium like Ron Watkins, who is widely believed to be the guy pretending to be Q, and Brandon Strzok also involved in that world or in that category. And then small and micro. I don't know who's included in those lists, but I wish that they'd included them because it would have been really funny. But anyway, the plan is described as a nationwide communications outreach campaign to educate the public on the fraud numbers and inspire citizens to call upon legislators and members of Congress to disregard the fraudulent vote count. And by that, they mean the vote count. And certify the duly elected President Trump. It also, by the way, listed Rudy Giuliani as the head of this social media operation. Other people in the Trump circle are there, but they're only identified by initials. So there's a little bit of speculation there, although not necessarily that difficult. So what we have here is a social media campaign designed to use various facets of conservative right-wing media to spread disinformation in advance of the vote certification and to get people jazzed for the idea that Joe Biden, despite winning the election, would not become president. We have some more details, which we'll get into. But Nina, what are your thoughts about this? Are you also at all surprised that they were trying to tap people like Ben Shapiro and Candace Owens to be a part of this effort?
Not surprised at all. And anytime Rudy Giuliani is at the top of the list, you know it's a problem. I mean, you want to talk about fraud. Just everything they were trying to do was a fraud, perpetrating a fraud on the American people, trying to psych people out, getting their base even more ginned up on this false narrative that Trump actually won the election, that somehow it was stolen from him. Look, their candidate did not win, and those are the facts, period. There was no fraud. So, no, I'm not surprised. They have definitely proven themselves, John, to be able to go, that they are willing to go to any lengths to keep this false narrative, this fraudulent narrative alive.
Definitely. Let's give you a little bit more information that was revealed from the documents from Bernie Kerik. So it includes a list of 10 right-wing TikTokers and admonishes, quote, "We have to use TikTok. Content goes viral here like no other platform. And there are millions of Trump supporters. It would be amazing if POTUS would use the platform, actually. He'd have the biggest account ever." And so here's the thing. Like, I don't doubt that there are millions of right-wingers on TikTok. I know TikTok has had to deal with, like, COVID misinformation and the big lie and everything. That sort of demonstrates that they are there. And if they were to get Trump to use it, it would almost certainly help him out in the time leading up to him inevitably being banned from the platform. But I would say I kind of wish that he had, because, man, that could have ended up being hilarious if he tried to do some of that TikTok-y stuff. Like, if he's just doing his little, like, fist-pumping dance to bits of right-wing misinformation. Like, I would have liked that for about a week, but unfortunately, we didn't get it. Anyway, other avenues for disseminating misinformation include Trump and Giuliani's Twitter feeds. Remember, this was from a time when Trump was allowed on Twitter. Conservative bloggers and social media influencers on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. Now, to be clear, we do not know if some of the people that were not in the direct employ of Trump actually were involved in this directly. Like Ben Shapiro and Candace Owens are listed there. We don't know that they actually communicated with the Trump team and participated. But whether they were knowingly participating or not, like as in like they had a conversation with Rudy Giuliani, they did participate. So in the period between December 27th and January 6th, Mark Levin tweeted that electors didn't have the constitutional authority to certify the election, which I don't even know what that means. They're literally the only ones that are allowed to do it. Candace Owens claimed that President Joe Biden cheated. Michael Knowles, who's another one of the Ben Shapiros or whatever, claimed that mail-in ballots gave him little faith in election integrity. Others harped on non-existent voter fraud in states like Georgia and Michigan. And these are all things that the media strategy was pushing for. Although, again, we don't know that they were directly contacted to do so. So I don't know. Like, does that distinction matter, Nina? And like, it's just the possibility that it could exist. I feel like the right wing is much better at tying together the political and media aspects of what they're doing. Like, I feel like they disseminate narratives much more quickly and much more thoroughly. I feel like if they want their base to believe something, it happens relatively quickly. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, no, they are very much organized. And certainly Mr. Trump took a president using social media to the next level. I mean, all of that practice he had for reality TV, he's masterful at it. Say what you want to say about him being a neo-fascist and all things evil. For the most part, I mean, he's masterful. And so for his team, even directly or indirectly, for him, for them to tap into that and that magic that he seems to have with social media and also with his followers is quite stunning. And you're right, they do. They organize it. Their narratives are very, you know, they put out emotional narratives, John. They don't try to be cerebral about it. It's all emotion. They have their base ginned up on emotion. And the Democratic side just does not do that in a good way.
Yeah.
Or as effectively, I will say. Because what they are doing, especially this topic you and I are talking about right now, is spreading falsehood and getting people all amped up over something that really is a lie.
Yeah. Yeah. And in this case, let's to be clear, it's not just that they want them to believe this stuff, but they very much did want them to be a part of it. So in this social media strategic communications plan, they had different varieties of live events that were supposed to be part of this. So they urged regular people to protest, to target election officials at their homes and offices, which we know they did. There were tons of death threats and people having to literally move out of their homes because they were being hounded out of their states. They said to target governors, lieutenant governors, locals, and weak members. They also called for protests in Washington, D.C., which, of course, did end up happening on January 6th. And a lot of this still exists. Like, the claims are still being made constantly. They've become, you know, more sophisticated in production value, if not substance, like with Tucker Carlson's sham January 6th documentary. But those sorts of protests have been ongoing ever since. Like, they filled people full of nonsense and then they sent them out there and they're still hounding, you know, whether it's school boards and things like that or election officials to this day. And that is a thing that I don't really see on our side. Obviously, we don't want this sort of thing.
No.
But I guess the big difference is that they can be in lockstep between their political leadership, their media arm, and their base, because they all, like, there are things theoretically that the base should want, but they've been trained not to believe that government should deliver for them. Like, spreading hatred, xenophobia, jealousy, stuff like that is all that there is. So they can do that together. On our side, what has Biden asked anyone to do? I mean, I guess he asked people to get vaccinated, but there's no popular movement even for his agenda. Like, I don't know. I don't want people to learn a lesson from this that they should, you know, they should, as you said, play to just these negative emotions constantly. But the right does seem to understand that people are supposed to be a part of this thing, and that at once an election is over, that isn't supposed to be the end of your organizing. And I'm not saying the left here, because the left is very much not in charge of the Democratic Party right now. But the Democrats, they seem to desire apathy, you know, aside from the 3 months leading up to an election.
Yeah, that's the key. And to me, really the moral of the story, besides the fact that these people are using power in a very wicked way, if you will, at least in my opinion, is that that engagement with the grassroots, with people who put you there on a regular basis, to have collaboration and to build coalition, that's really the word I'm looking for, means relationship. And say what what we will about how they're doing it and why they're doing it and how bad this is for democracy as a whole, they are building, even if it's artificial, a type of relationship, a type of coalition with the people who are on their side. And it is mainly, you know, tied to an emotion that they have tapped into. And you're right, the corporatism certainly have not done that, because they want people to vote and then off with you until we call summons you again. I mean, that is how they treat their voters and the people who are part of the party.
Yeah. Yeah, and like I was saying yesterday on the show, I just, like, it would be great at some point during my life slash involvement in this career field to just see what it's like to have that on our side. Like, to have a progressive president who's actually trying to get stuff done. Like, I don't want to set up false expectations for people. Like, if we're super lucky and we have an awesome progressive that runs in 2024 and becomes president, it is not that we've suddenly, like, we've gone through the veil and we're now in, you know, a land of milk and honey and everything. It's going to be devastating dealing with what is still going to be an incredibly hostile Senate, a Supreme Court that's stacked with conservatives. But to at least feel what it's like to be part of a movement that's based in honesty and an expectation that government can make things better, that would be a nice change of pace. I'd like to see.
Amen to that, John. And it, you know, even the fireside chats, and I talk about this often, I know a lot of people do, because FDR did this at a very critical time in our nation's history, going through the Great Depression and the havoc that it wreaked wreaked on a whole bunch of folks. We're right there again. You know, we are in a moment where this pandemic is just raging and destroying people's lives, definitely altering people's lives, even if it's not destroying everybody's life, but we're all indelibly linked. And so where is the moral consciousness coming from leaders who actually care that this is happening to people, that some people are better off, so the impacts don't necessarily totally destroy them? And then we got another set of people in this country who are not doing well at all. And we can't even get them to agree on paid family leave. We can't get them, I mean, just simple stuff like that. Lower the cost of prescription drugs, for God's sakes. Medicare for all is absolutely necessary. And if we can't get them to see things like that and communicate that you actually understand what people are going through, that is missing right now, John. And it is so needed, at least from people who are elected. There certainly are a lot of activists and thought leaders and civil rights leaders who are trying to make those connections. But from people who have a lot of power, it's not happening.
100%.
Yeah, in terms of elected power.
Yeah. Definitely. And they're actively blocking the people that you're talking about from ever being in power. Like, those people not only have to go up against the entirety of the right, but they have to go up against 99% of what is ostensibly their own side of the political spectrum. Because it's not truly. So January 6th, the anniversary, the first anniversary is coming up. And I don't know exactly what we're going to be doing here at TDR. Obviously, we'll be talking about the legacy and everything, but I do want you to have a heads up on one thing that's going to be happening on that day. And it's, I don't know, I'll say the worst thing that could happen on that day other than a direct repeat of the insurrection. Former President Donald Trump is going to be holding a news conference on the anniversary of January 6th. He said he will discuss the events of that day. It's going to be held in his resort in Palm Beach, Florida. And in the press release where he said that he's going to do this, he claimed that he won the election, that it was stolen from Biden. So if you think that he has had time to reflect on the claims he's made and the damage it's done to American democracy and tens of millions of Americans' faith in democracy, he has not used that time in that way. So he's apparently going to call Pelosi's investigation, the January 6th Commission, a witch hunt, and embrace the protests of last year as a legitimate reaction to a stolen election on November 3rd. So he was begrudgingly forced to come out and ask people to leave last January 6th and then told them he loved them. A few days later, he claimed that it was a bad thing that happened while still hinting that it wasn't his people. Now a year later, he is saying it was good. It was a good thing that happened. And he's going to be doing that on January 6th. So Nina Turner, I'm curious, do you think that, are you at all worried about him using this anniversary to rally his supporters? Do you think it's going to matter? Or do you think, in comparison to all else of what's been happening in the past year, that it's not something that we should worry too much about?
And we all should be concerned. Mr. Trump is a showman, if nothing else, and he's very good at it. So even if nothing spectacular happens on January 6th, which I hope it doesn't, if it's spectacular, I hope it's spectacularly good. But if nothing spectacularly bad happens on January 6th, what he's doing is continuing to build on the foundation of hate, the foundation of fear, the foundation of deception. And that is going to have an impact on our entire country, John, for a very long time.
Yeah. Yeah, I am worried that this could be the sort of date that, you know, random wackos decide is the time when they can, you know, like follow in the legacy of the insurrectionists by doing something. It's entirely possible that that won't happen, that there won't be violent protests, that there won't be an act of mass violence. But I think it's perfectly legitimate for people to be worried about that. I just want to also point out, we're not doing the video. We might use some of it tomorrow, but CNN's Donnie O'Sullivan, their reporter who goes and like talks to Trump supporters at rallies and everything, he has this new video that's out where he's talking to tons of them now, and they're all saying that they buy all of the lies about January 6th. It wasn't Trump supporters. It wasn't anyone that likes Trump. It was all fake. The people that have been arrested and tried weren't there or weren't Trump supporters. And meanwhile, as they all believe that all of that was fake, it was either Antifa or leftists, or maybe it was some conservatives, but only because the FBI made them do it. At the same time, Trump is telling them last January 6th was awesome. It was legitimate. It should happen. And they, like, those are incompatible thoughts, that it was bad, but not our fault. We didn't do it. And it was great and it should have happened. But they're not going to have any like cognitive dissonance at that. These two fundamentally opposed concepts. There is, as always, a particular sort of perverse mental flexibility in the brains of those on the right.
That's exactly right. And Donald Trump is the king of it.
Yeah. Well, and I think he understands it better than anyone else. He understands that there's no expectation of consistency. There's no desire for a lack of hypocrisy or anything like that.
Yeah.
Really fast, the last thing I want to say, Media Matters has hopes for media in the US. And so in this case, they have some advice for the media in advance of this press conference. So Angelo Carasone, who's been on our show before, says his press event should be recognized for what it is, an opportunity for Trump to lie, to downplay the violent insurrection at the US Capitol and set up his 2024 presidential campaign. It is critical that news networks do the right thing, refuse to carry it live so they do not uncritically promote the lies and disinformation that is generated from Trump's speech in real time. I agree. We will almost certainly have commentary about what happens, but I have no interest, even on our network, playing it live. And I have very little concern that anyone watching on our network would be like accepting in real time what they're hearing from Trump. But that said, we are going to provide context if we cover it at all. And so we'll see. I think that the media, Nina, has become a little bit better than they were in 2016, where they would just devote 6 hours to an empty podium waiting for Trump to speak. But I think that there is a level of newsworthy, arguable newsworthiness, and a belief that it will generate attention that worries me that there will be a lot of live coverage of this event on the 6th. What do you think?
Yeah, and the advice that Media Matters has given is right on. People have to, media, John, on that side, it's all about the clickbait now instead of sharing real news and information. And what is the role and responsibility of journalists and journalism and these media companies, because it's not the individual journalist, to do just that?
Yeah.
Trump made these people so much money, John, in 2016. That's why they watched the podium when he wasn't there. This is why all they cared about was the ratings and the money.
Yeah.
And look what it created.
Yeah.
So they need to atone for that.
100%. I hope the money was good. I hope the views
were
helpful.
Worth it? Yeah. Was it worth it?
Yeah. Well, with that, we are going to take our first break and respond to some of your comments. When we come back, Virginia is at a standstill thanks to snow. And Airbnb, which is getting bigger and bigger every year, is having to deal with some baked in racism in the system. We'll give you updates on that after this. Okay, so what you just saw there might not seem like the most exciting footage ever. Nighttime traffic just not moving in the snow. But what is interesting about it is how long it didn't move. What you're seeing there is insane highway gridlock in Virginia. Hundreds of motorists being stranded along a 50-mile stretch of Interstate 95 in Virginia for more than 15 hours. This apparently came about as a result of a couple different factors. One was a tragic crash involving 6 tractor trailers. Apparently they had over a foot of snow, difficulty clearing both of those obstructions away. And so as a result, along a 50-mile stretch, they were just stranded, freezing temperatures for hours and hours and hours. This is after the first mid-Atlantic storm of the year dumped more than a foot of snow across the entire region. So that is the experience that people had. As many hours went by, they had to decide, do I stay in a freezing car at the risk of eventually running out of gas? Do I abandon it to try to get to somewhere safe and warm? And you know, the government tried to respond. Governor Ralph Northam put out a tweet saying, my team has been working throughout the night to respond to the situation. They're clearing down trees, assisting disabled vehicles, and rerouting drivers. But some people involved in media and politics were actually stuck in that traffic jam. So Josh Lederman of NBC News live tweeted the obstruction, saying at that point he had been stuck for more than 7 hours, not moving, 30 miles south of DC. He said it's not just cars, there are disabled vehicles along the interstate, semis, everything. People run out of gas, they abandon their vehicles. Some would get out of their cars to take exercise breaks, including walking their dogs. Or he said he was melting snow in a bowl so that his dog would have water to drink. And he said around the 5 hour mark, it got really scary. 27 degrees outside, no way for medical or emergency personnel to reach people stuck in this. One of the people stuck in this apparently was Senator Tim Kaine. He was stuck for 19 hours, apparently boxed in amongst these semis. And so look, it's a complex thing. It's an infrastructure issue. It's an issue of apparently more snow than was expected. I've been stuck in traffic, nothing like this, Nina. Just the idea of being there for hours and hours without moving, especially in terrible weather like that, is devastating.
Yeah, it really is. And hopefully there'll be some promise in this problem that they will figure out a way to make sure that something like this never happens again. A very long time. I mean, bathroom breaks, food, I mean, you name it, all of the things that you think about when you're in a moment like that. I mean, I'm from Ohio, and Cleveland, Ohio, at that lake effect is real. And I remember, John, you know, many years ago getting stuck in a snowstorm and coming from the State House, actually, trying to get from Columbus to Cleveland. And luckily I was with a fellow Northeast Ohioan, but it was really bad. We didn't think that we were going to make it. I mean, the snow, you talked about going, inching our way towards Northeast Ohio. Probably should not have been in that weather trying to get home. It was like blizzard-like, but yeah, we were moving. So again, these things happen, unfortunately. Hopefully they will learn something from it and try to fix the system. I want to say to people during the winter, please keep something in, you should have an emergency kit.
Yeah,
just in
that's
case.
A great idea.
And I'm not blaming anybody. I'm just saying blankets, flashlight, food even, yep. You know, maybe some canned food and some snacks and that kind of thing. Cause stuff like that can keep in the winter cause you know, it's cold outside. So you don't have to necessarily worry about anything going bad, but please keep an emergency kit in your car. Not sure an emergency kit could have solved all of the problems, because that was agonizing what they went through, John. Oh my God.
Yeah, I can't, like, yeah, that's a great idea, having like just like a box of protein bars or something, yeah, just in case to sustain
water,
you.
Water, blankets, gloves, make sure, because something, you know, people in the winter, they just assume that they're going to always be on the go, that their cars are, you know, and some people don't wear a coat or they don't have gloves. Just have a kit that has all of the essentials in them. And then the workers, I want to shout out the government workers and others that were really trying to help get people out of that situation. That is a moment where we definitely needed all hands on deck.
Totally, totally. Yeah. And then thankfully we had that. We had the emergency workers. I know, I think it might have been Tim Kaine who said there was some family in a car from Connecticut that was like handing out oranges to different cars, like walking around. Like there were people that were trying to help. And you know what? I kind of like, we're focusing on the people that were helping. We were gonna go to someone who was trying to use it for his own political purposes and being absolutely awful. Today, we're gonna skip it. You know what? New year, new approach to a-holes on Twitter. I'm not gonna read it, actually. But we do have some other bad people. So let's transition to our next story. We can't avoid all of the badness. Okay. Airbnb is huge. You probably know that, but it's actually just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Back in 2015, they had more than 2 million listings on the platform. At that point, 6 years ago, it was nearly four times as many rooms as the Marriott hotel chain. And we know that it's only gotten bigger since then. It's actually intersecting with other problems with the housing market, where more and more houses are being converted over into permanent Airbnbs. It's a massive problem. And it's a multifaceted problem. I want to focus on one aspect of it, which The Guardian has done some great reporting on. That is racism in Airbnb. Now, it might not be immediately clear how this would manifest, but it's a huge issue. And it's been an issue for absolutely years. Airbnb has done some limited things occasionally to try to fight back against this. They have one new recent move. Airbnb rental hosts in Oregon will no longer be able to see guests' names before approving their bookings. So this is apparently designed to fight back against some of the racism that's been seen on the platform. The policy update is specific just to the state of Oregon and was born out of a lawsuit in which three black women from Portland alleged that the rental site's use of names and photographs allowed for racial discrimination, violating the state's public accommodation laws. That suit was settled back in 2019, and starting on the 31st of this month, Airbnb says that hosts in Oregon will only see a guest's initials until their booking is confirmed, only after which their full name will be visible. The update will be in effect for at least 2 years. People are saying that if they have a name that they believe reads as black, that they are less likely to be allowed accommodations. And this is a very late, multi-years after the lawsuit's effort to fight back against this. Interestingly, only in Oregon, Nina, and I feel like that sort of racism might not be limited to Oregon, perhaps. I feel like it might go beyond maybe like Washington, maybe into a little bit of California a little bit. I don't know. What do you think?
I think you're onto something, John. How about the United States? Mm-hmm. I mean, they need to initiate that policy all across the country. And certainly there have been studies over the years of social scientists really studying this, and the outcome has been, or what they discovered was that yes, some people make judgments based on your name. Like even in when people are applying for jobs, if your name was too ethnic and it may have revealed that you were African American or another person of color, the risk of your resume going into file 13 was very real. There's conversations even to this day in the African American community about how we name our children, and must we be subjected? I mean, you know, this is real, and people might not think about this all the time, but should the African American community be subjected, as we often are, to even making the decision on naming your child and making sure that name is not too ethnic to protect them into the future? And that's pretty sad. We see crown laws, you know, have are on the books now. And if people don't know what those are, you know, to protect African American, it primarily was born from the discrimination that African Americans face, particularly African American women, for how they wear their hair. If they're not wearing it Eurocentric, or if they have locks, and African American men too, they want to wear Afro. But that was born from the discrimination and bigotry that the African American community face. And now it can benefit all people, that folks should be able to wear their hair the way that they want to wear their hair, and it should not be judged or measured on some Eurocentric standard of beauty. And so, yes, newsflash, that happens with names as well.
Yeah, 100%. And it's obviously like whether it's in Airbnb or, as you're saying, you know, this is in, you know, seeking employment, university admissions, like it's difficult to even know where exactly this stops. It's obviously damaging to the people that it hurts. It's also stupidly self-destructive for the employers, because I get news for them. How someone wears their hair has nothing to do with their ability to do literally any job that you can come up with. And so they are harming their ability to choose the best candidates, whether it's for a job, a spot in a university, a spot in an Airbnb. And we actually have an example of that right here. So I'm gonna catch up a little bit. In 2015 and 2016, there was hashtag Airbnb while black, where people talked about their experiences with racism while using the platform. Some people, black users, were saying that they would change their names online or use generic profile photos, post photos of white individuals so that they can, get these bookings. It reminds me of recent stories of people who are having their homes assessed, having like white friends come over for the assessor to be there for. And they find that they actually have a significantly higher assessment of their home value. Absolutely insane racism. So how does this actually affect the racists? A 2016 Harvard Business School study found that requests from guests with distinctively African-American names are roughly 16% less likely to be accepted than identical guests with distinctively white names. But what they found was hosts pay a price for their bias. When hosts rejected a black guest, they only found a replacement about a third of the time. And so they're missing out on days renting their Airbnb, stupidly allowing their racism to stop them from getting the money that is the entire point that they're on Airbnb for. By the way, they also found that this works in reverse. Black hosts generally earned less money because people would discriminate against hosts that have names or pictures that identify them as black. So man, it's just, and like the whole time this is happening, and there's a social movement fighting back against it. A corporation is doing a little bit to try to ameliorate it. Universities are investigating it, Nina. You have all these people in positions of power that are like, yeah, but Obama got elected. And so I feel like we moved past.
We're in a
like
post-racial, right? We're in a post-racial society. Yeah. Are you flipping kidding me? And you know, I have some elders in my life, and they actually, well, we all have elders in our life, but they live, you know, live in California, and hearing you talk about this, they want to, you know, scale down their house. They're getting up in age, and so they want to, you know, get into a smaller place. They have beautiful art, John, beautiful Afrocentric art everywhere. And the missus said, you know what, we're gonna have to take all of that artwork off of our walls before we show our house. Ugh. And when I say it's beautiful, I mean, walking through their home, you feel like you are in an art museum. They put so much love into what they pick to put on their walls. But just the very thought, did y'all hear what I just said? They got to take their stuff off their walls,
yeah,
to sell their house to make sure they can get the best price possible.
Yeah. We're such irrational creatures.
Jesus.
The art isn't going to be there after you buy it. Like, why would that influence you, you maniac? Oh, I don't understand people. And but it does. It, like, the assessor thing is true. That is madness.
It is.
We're humans.
And these are the microaggressions, you know, that African Americans have to go through on a regular basis. And until someone like you, that us having these kinds of conversations, people just kind of forget that extra stress that is on a black person just because they are black. And yeah, those little things add up. And then when you wrap that with all the other things that life throws at you, this is why black people die at higher rate, you know, high blood pressure, heart attack. All of those microaggressions really do add up, John. It's stressful as hell. It really is.
And you know, at the expense of going along, I apologize, but like when we, yeah, every once in a while, there's like an effort to get some people to understand the concept of privilege, and you know, like intellectually dishonest right wing pundits will fight back saying, "Well, I didn't do this. I didn't, you know, I didn't establish, you know, like a sundown town, or I didn't have slaves." Yes, but you don't have to worry when you try to book a room on Airbnb that your name, Charlie Kirk, is gonna make racists block you from having, like, that is what privilege is about. By its very nature, you don't have to have done anything. I don't have to take down my art when I try to sell my house. My stupid Lord of the Rings posters aren't gonna cause people to not buy the house. That's what privilege is like. It doesn't have to be active necessarily. Anyway, okay. We are gonna take our second break. When we come back, we've got some updates on COVID and children. So you know it's gonna be fun after this. We all want everyone to get vaccinated, and most people agree that even kids eventually, once it's proven the different age categories that it's safe to vaccinate them, should get vaccinated. That said, it does have to be consensual though. And unfortunately, a teacher in New York has now been arrested for injecting a minor with a COVID-19 vaccine without the consent of the kid's parents. That's according to police. This is Laura Russo, a 54-year-old, arrested on New Year's Eve after police were informed that she had allegedly injected a 17-year-old boy with a vaccine. So the age of her doesn't really matter, but the age of the 17-year-old does. He is on the cusp of being able to go out and get it himself. That said, he is on the wrong side of the cusp legally, and she's on the wrong side of the law. So she apparently had a vial of an approved COVID-19 vaccine in her home, though police didn't say where she got it. According to officials, her son had a friend over, And the friend asked for the vaccine because his mother allegedly didn't want to have him inoculated against COVID at this point. The teenager told his mother when he got home that he'd gotten the vaccine, and the mom notified the police. She is, of course, not authorized to administer vaccines to anyone. She's a teacher. She's not a nurse or a doctor. She's a teacher at Herricks High School in New Hyde Park, according to a biography on the school's website. And she has been removed from classroom duty and reassigned. And the school's in kind of a difficult position here, because obviously that's unacceptable. But also contextually, with the way anti-vaxxers have been in the last year, and in particular, the way right-wing parents have been towards schools, can you imagine the storm that is about to descend on that school if they don't suspend this teacher? It'll be a crowd 50 deep of wackos and red hats chanting against them. That said, like, I want the kid to get vaccinated. He's a 17-year-old, he needs to get vaccinated, but this is not the way to do it. And so obviously what she did is wrong. But that said, I want to add one little extra wrinkle to this, and maybe we can get a Twitch poll going on. The story makes it seem as if it's fairly clear who the villain is, but I want to just make sure. So if Brooke is, or someone else who can manage polls on Twitch is there, who is the true villain here? Is it A, the teacher who administered a vaccine that she shouldn't have even had, let alone be administering to other people's kids? Is it B, the other mom who won't let the kid get vaccinated when he wants to? It is willing to risk him potentially getting sick or someone else getting sick via him? Or C, is it the kid? Because he tattled. Like, let's keep it real. Like, he shouldn't have had, you know, medicine given to him by someone who is not licensed to do it. But at the same time, why did he tell his mom, who he knows is anti-vax? And I just feel like he needlessly snitched. And I'm normally in favor of snitching. I like laws. But in this case, I feel like everybody's sort of wrong, although only the teacher is wrong legally. So it looks like we do. Oh, thank you. We do have the poll up on Twitch. Who's the villain, the teacher, the student, or the mom? And the results look pretty clear. So we're going to give you the results in just a little bit. But anyway, don't have personal doses of the vaccine. Just go to like Walgreens or CVS and get it done. You shouldn't be bringing any of that home. But that said, if you do have the ability to get vaccinated, or if you are responsible for a minor that is in an age category that has been approved for vaccination, please let them get it. We've got devastating case numbers, as we'll get to in just a little bit, and we need as many people vaccinated as possible, but not by any means possible. Don't do it to other people's kids. Okay, everybody, it's about to get serious. Let's talk about it. So everybody knows that we've been having a rough time during the pandemic in terms of public health, in terms of the economy, employment, and all that. It's been rough. It's been rough for adults, but we also understand it's been rough for kids. And we want to go through some of the ways that it has been rough and that it's getting even worse. So the New York Times' David Leinhart had a great write-up of some of the educational and mental health impacts, but we also want to give you updates on the COVID situation. So first of all, in terms of education, children fell far behind in school during the first year of the pandemic and have not caught up. Among third through eighth graders, math and reading levels were all lower than normal this fall, according to NWEA, a research group. The shortfalls were largest for Black and Hispanic students, as well as students in schools with high poverty rates. So that is not going to surprise a lot of people that the already baked in inequities were only going to be exacerbated. Why not? They were economically, and in terms of actual like infections and, you know, hospitalizations of COVID, deaths from COVID, why not in the education too? And so that's an issue that, you know, I don't know how much is being done, Nina, to correct that all kids are sort of behind, but that it's worst for Black and Hispanic students. And that's the sort of thing that theoretically could influence the rest of your life. It could influence your ability to get into higher education, which could influence the jobs and the income that you eventually get. This is something that's now being baked in that could have lifelong effects.
That's exactly right. And it requires a national response. Certainly local school districts are, some of them, you know, have plans in place and are trying to do what they can. But this does require local, state, and federal action to make sure that we secure our children's education. Just imagine having to go to school at this point in human history. It is going to have a ripple, a very long ripple effect for those children and also for their families. And we already know that children lose, you know, if you don't keep pace, even in the summertime, you know, as we debate whether or not schools, K through 12 education in particular, should be more modeled after the college model, where you just have a couple of weeks off, but you're in, you know, constantly, like all year. We do know that in school systems where children are in school year round, instead of having that whole summer off, those kids, those young, those children maintain more of what they're being taught. And you're absolutely right. It is exacerbated by race and class, caste and class all the time. We know this in everything, anything, anything we can name. We know it is always exacerbated, especially if it's negative, by caste, meaning ethnic and racial, and class, poor people from all walks of life.
Which is really weird, because we established in the last block that we've moved beyond America's legacy of racism. So I don't know how it's still affecting us for some reason. Now, in addition to the directly educational outcomes, the threat to students' lives has become worse in a couple of different ways. Suicide attempts have risen slightly among adolescent boys and sharply among adolescent girls. The number of ER visits for suspected suicide attempts by 12 to 17 year old girls rose by 51% between early 2019 and early 2021. And you can jump ahead, we'll show you this chart showing the different year. And you can see that 2021 is sharply higher there. Gun violence against students has also increased. There was a big drop off in school shootings in 2020. Not surprisingly, most schools were in session. Well, schools have come back and the shootings have come back as well. In fact, shooting, like again, pardon the expression there, but rising far higher than even record years before the pandemic, despite the fact that we've been through this horrible experience together, and one would think that that would draw us together, and the fact that not every school is totally in session, we do see that these shootings are higher there last year, Nina.
Yeah, a lot of stressors. I believe social media has a lot to do with the suicides and depression. I mean, the images that are there, people trying to live up to the images. It's hard enough when you're grown, let's know being a teenager and being very impressionable. So it is going to be important for parents and guardians to do everything that they can to guard the minds of their young children as much as they can. And this whole comparison culture, John, and we know this has been going on since human existence, but social media has it more in your face of you trying to compare yourself or compare your life, what you have, don't have, to what somebody else has and doesn't have. And it's draining. It drains your soul and your spirit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a huge problem. And like, I'll remind people, when the Facebook papers came out, that was one of the big things they talked about, was Facebook's research into Instagram and the effect that it has on mental health, especially in young girls. So like, we know about this and we had that additional evidence, but we're not, are we doing anything? Like, what is the solution? Like, another problem to deal with. Kids are really getting it from a lot of different directions simultaneously, and one of those directions is COVID. Because I know what you've heard since the beginning of the pandemic. It's not a thing that kids have to worry about, and so don't worry about it. Well, you probably should, because according to an NBC News analysis, at least 9 states have reported record numbers of COVID-related pediatric hospitalizations, from Connecticut through states in the Northeast, in the South, Washington DC as well. There were at least 325,000 cases reported during the week of December 23rd, compared with a little bit more than half that a week earlier. And serious illness from COVID is still rare for young numbers, but the sheer number of new cases worries doctors, because this is the thing about something that is rare. It's rare, but if you massively increase the number of chances of that rare thing happening, you are, by your very nature, going to increase the number of times that it has happened. And so hospitalizations are going up. And of course, the vast, vast majority of these kids are not vaccinated, either because some of them are too young to be vaccinated, or they're in the group that can be, but their parents are declining from letting them be. And so really fast, I just want to read this last point. A doctor is talking about how effectively every kid in a children's hospital in New York was COVID positive. He says, many of these kids are not sick because of COVID, but just screened positive, highlighting how widespread positivity is right now. But there are a good number of kids who are sick due to COVID and filling up ICUs. So it is getting rough in terms of that as well. So don't believe the propaganda.
No, don't believe it. Kids may be a little more resilient and rebounding, but come on, it's not like they had superpowers where they can, the virus just gonna bounce off of them. That has never been true.
Exactly. Yeah, it's rare, and let's try to keep it really rare by not having a massive number of kids getting sick in general.
Yeah.
Anyway, unfortunately, that's all the time we have in this first hour, which means it's all the time we unfortunately have with Nina Turner. Nina, it is always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, John. The Black Pearl Dragon will return next week.
I hope so. And everyone, check out Power Hour coming up this Thursday. Become a member. And we've got more news for you, YouTube and Twitch. Don't go anywhere. I'll be back in just a few.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.